This is volume one of These Days. And I guess I'm going somewhere with that. I guess this is akin to the old garage sales, in a sense. The days of the Zagat's Grassy Knoll. This is now Beyond the Grassy Knoll. And this is volume one of These Days. A couple things real quick. I'm recording this on, I guess this is what... Too many days to little brain cells. Monday, May 19th. We were late with the audio, which will be up, as we said, Tuesday the 20th. I just want to get this in. This was not what held it up. We had a little situation that occurred late last week. It put kind of a literal dent in our lives. But anyway, I'm just curious. I mean, have any of you thought about this, first of all? Like, how many 20th hijackers do we have? Wasn't Miss Sally the 20th and not his other cat is the 20th? Then I started thinking, how many 9/11 masterminds were there? You know, the Sheikh cat is, you know, he's one. Bin Laden was one, and we got Saddam in there somehow, some way. But they get real staying power out of their boogeymen, don't they? Another thing, and I'll admit, I'm ignorant of classic politics in the United States because I know it isn't worth a hoot. But I got to admit, I talked to Pilot Pete about this, and I said, you know, did you ever hear of superdelegates before? And he went, no, I didn't. You know, and where's that coming from? And I'm like, I don't know. Did I miss something across, you know, the last decades or so? Superdelegates, where did they come from? All right. I'll plead ignorance, and I'll plead guilty. Now, one of the real interesting things that happened last week, Joey Ratzinger, what a guy. Bush looked in his eyes and saw God, huh? You look in Joey Ratz's eyes, you see God in there, I see somebody else in there. Woohoo! Anyway, so now, like last week, it's okay now that well, let's just read this. Vatican City, Associated Press, Vatican astronomer says it's okay to believe in aliens. Well, thanks for that. Believing that the universe may contain alien life does not contradict the faith in God, the Vatican's chief astronomer said in an interview published Tuesday. And that's true. We don't know. The Reverend Jose Gabriel Fuentes, the Jesuit director of the Vatican Observatory, why do you know, was quoted as saying the vastness of the universe means it is possible there could be other forms of life outside Earth, even intelligent ones. All right, now, I'm not going to go on and on about this, but you know what's really rich, too? You know, you heard this when Chica Bruce was on, and you probably heard this from other people, too, especially you folks, and I'm not saying this derogatorily, who are... kind of like ufologists, you know, buffs and such. You've heard it said before that when it came to that miracle of Fatima in Majuri or whatever, that it was UFO sightings that a Jesuit priest in Spain said, no, whoa, no, that was a miracle. He kiboshed that, now they're unkiboshing all that stuff. And wasn't it also said, was it by Joey Ratz or somebody else, that aliens could be, and most probably are, intelligent and benign. So there's nothing that we should be afraid of. And, I love this, therewith out original sin. Now, how would he or anybody know that? Because they weren't born on Earth. What is it, Earth only? If there's God's creation, I doubt he made anybody perfect. Because he alone is. Alone. Now, you know, those who are Catholics and listen, and you want to get cranked about this, that's fine. Because I'm asking you to put your nose back in the scripture where it said there is no one born of woman who is without sin except Jesus Christ. So your infallible Pope stuff, take a hike. No. That is heresy. Don't take it up with me, take it up with Jehovah. Now, let's see what else we have here. Yeah, okay. Moving on, I listened to Coast to Coast a couple of times in the last 6 to 8 weeks. I thought it was interesting that Steve Quayle was on twice within that span, I'd say about 4 weeks. He was on with Ian Pundit, a smarmy little up in, wherever is he now, Minnesota? Is he back in Minnesota? I don't know. And they didn't get along too well. But George Norrie had him on later on, and they just got along famously. And I got to tell you this, I don't trust Coast to Coast, especially when it comes to shaping opinion about things like global warming, what happened in 9/11. Norrie is a lying piece of crap. He is an absolute two-face. I want to tell you a little story, too. He was supposed to show up at Adam Gilrightly's UFO conference somewhere in that third week of April. And he had demands. He wanted to be picked up in a Lincoln Town Car. Not anything else, a Lincoln Town Car. It had to be a Lincoln Town Car. And then he wanted one for his use while he was out there. And Adam was thinking, like, well, gee, George, I mean, there's really no place to go out there. You just want to take him, what, rip across the desert? Anyway, after all these machinations, George pulled out. You know, yeah, you pray for George. I'm not. At any rate, and he's such a phony, too. I mean, oh, God. That's amazing. So Quayle's on, and, you know, Quayle's a very likable person, and he has a great deal of credibility. You know, he says the Jesus things and the God things just enough. And I'm not saying he doesn't know Christ. I mean, I wouldn't say that. But I do know that he's often very wrong, and he's got more people running for the high ground than Moses. When he was on that second time with Nora, I mean, one woman was in tears calling up, and the other one is in Oklahoma saying, I'll do anything you tell me, Steve. Boy. Whoa, you know, step back and think about this. Now, a lot of what Quayle says, you know, I have to say I believe also. But how many times can they kill you? So, I mean, are we worrying about detention camps? And are we worrying about World War III? And are we worried about civil insurrection if the illegals go militant, which they're pretty much foretold to do? So, I mean, and he's got people going, well, you know, we'll go to the mountains. That's the safest place to be where there's good hospitals and such. Well, if everybody goes to the same place, guess what? You know how the old song goes from the Eagles? Call something paradise, kiss it goodbye. You got to use your head, folks. You know, if everybody identifies the same place as the place to go and they actually try to get there, that's all going to get, you know, frigged up too. So, come on. Be realistic if you can. If you're going to do anything, do it now. It's like the old story down here when there's a hurricane. You know, if you wait till the last moment when they tell you, oh, by the way, it is coming down your throat, then by the time you get to the highway, you'll be a sitting duck on the interstates, which are all jammed anyway. You're going to do it. You got to go early and roll the dice. If there's no hurricane, so what? You had a road trip. And it's the same here with people who want to split. You know, if you got some relatives up in the high ground, I agree. I think you should go to the mountains. The mountains have historically been a place that's been protected. And I think that that's also scriptural. But I don't know how many people can get there. And then the other thing is, if you don't have anyone there, how do you sustain yourself? You know, where are you going to live? Are you going to get a job? Do you need a job? So you got to think about these things. And as I'm saying this, I want to get out of here. I want to get out of here to the low ground. But if I don't do it soon, and I know it, we're not going to get it done. I mean, I'm not getting any younger either. But Florida? Whoa, baby. Stay out of here, all you folks. If you're not here, don't come here. Because it's not pretty for a lot of reasons with the shape of things to come. But anyway, so Quayle was on there, and it was interesting. But I think people still have to temper what they hear with the doability, the plausibility of making plans. Probably most folks are going to have to tough it out where they are and hope for the best. He talks about earthquakes and such. You know, I don't know. I mean, we wonder if there's going to be some kind of geological event here. That's a possibility, but certainly I believe he's right, too, when he talks about, and we've said this, you know, for years, that if we go to a regional forum on our way to world government, we've got to forget all about D.C., whatever good it was anyway, but, you know, and they'll dust D.C., there's no two ways about it. And I still think back to that movie, The Sum of All Fears, with this whole bit about predictive programming and telling you it's going to come, so it's okay to do it to you because they gave you a fair warning, I would say that the next terror event is most likely going to be what they portrayed in Sum of All Fears. Whether it's Baltimore or not, I don't know that it matters, but that it's going to take place probably in a situation like that, where all those who are watching that game that day and all those in the stadium, God forbid, will get a first-hand look at probably the next terror event. Also, Quayle was lauding Alex Jones a number of times. And, you know, I tell you what, you know, Coast to Coast, What's the sense of being there? I don't know it. Maybe what Norrie and the show is doing is trying to grab more Patriot listeners and bring him in, you know, being all things to all people. Because honestly, like I said, the one time I heard him talk, when he had a bunch of JFK researchers on, he's going, we got to get down to the bottom of this. And yet 9/11 was 19 Arab hijackers. I mean, come on. You know, the guy's a steaming pile of dung. But anyway, so I listen, and the show really sucks lately, too. I have to admit, it looks like it's hard for them to sustain 7 days a week. I would assume it would be. And when the callers call in, I can't, you know. I listen to it mostly to go to sleep, and sometimes it's so pathetic I got to actually put the TV on and watch the Home Shopping Network just to go to sleep. And the thing about Jones is everybody's raising their eyeballs because Jones came out, and I guess on his show he talked about the Vatican. I don't even know what he talked about. All I know is I got this sent to me, and this was the show promo for when he takes whatever he did, I guess, in the fourth hour. I have no idea what he does. I don't want to ever listen to him again because it's hard for me to keep down solid food when I listen to him. And I bet you he goes mainstream, man. I bet you he flips and goes mainstream. Don't count this out. And how many people is he going to take with him? Just like this whole thing about Ron Paul, our last hope. Well, I guess our last hope just went, Alex, and now what do we do? Okay, he flips and you know, goes, and all of a sudden government can be saved, and the presidents are figureheads, and Ron Paul's the answer, our last hope, and that's not going to happen. So what are you telling your listeners now, Alex? You know, shut the light off before you leave? And here's the promo. Alex discusses how the upper echelons of the Catholic Church, including the Pope, are involved in the New World Order power structure, but how confusion and ninnying about the influence of different groups stymies people from becoming involved in productive grassroots activism. Now, here you had him probably kicking and dragging to talk about whatever he's talking about. And I don't agree with this comes from the upper echelons of the Catholic Church. That's what he said. All right? And then he says, and then he goes, but, you know, this causes confusion and ninnying. Why do you use that word, ninnying? About the influence of different groups that stymies people from becoming involved. It doesn't stymie anybody. That's what you said. So here he does it, and then he gives you a caveat right with it. And that's what, when people send it to me going, do you believe this? I'm like, well, look, you already went ahead and debunked it in this, with this, even this release. Now, here's the thing. I don't think it's the Catholic Church. I don't think it's the Catholic parishioners. Now, they got a problem with me saying that the Pope and the Vatican's got nothing to do with religion. I should say spirituality. That's too bad. I don't see the Catholic Church being used as anything else but as a spiritual or slash religious facade for what takes place behind the scenes in the Vatican, which, remember, is a nation state. I don't look at them as being spiritual. I don't look at the Pope as being spiritual. And certainly the Society of Jesus are the ones who are doing things with the Pope as a figurehead, just like what happens in the United States with the President as a figurehead. Now, if you got a problem with me, a problem with that, that's fine. Okay? But I don't say it's the Catholic Church. I'm saying it's something that is just faking being religious. So that Alex talked about it, who cares? What does that make it all right now? And then he goes ahead and he offers this, and that, let's not talk about it because it only just, you know, stops grassroots activism. Where'd you come up with that? All right, so watch him. Watch the creep. He'll flip one more time. He'll be on Fox before you know it. All right, now, on to better things. We all kind of believe, and for good reason, that wars, especially in the 20th century, have been scripted. And that we know that there's been two nasty ones already, and of course, there's never really been a period of peace anywhere. And we've seen, you know, the United States military is like fighting every single one of them. But we often think about the Third World War. Most of us believe it's going to come because it almost seems inexorable that mankind can be kept from it. Now, there is talk about the Pike-Manzini letter, which foretold that there would be a third world war, and it would pretty much be this Islam-Christian thing. Now, the letter is reputed to be real. We had a guest on by the name of Bill Still, William Still, who wrote New World Order. We did a show with him a couple of times, one on that, one on the Money Masters, which he did a documentary to that title. Very good. And Still said to me, because they did some taping in the London Museum, and he said he saw it, but it has since been removed. I'll take him at his word. Anyway, it's supposed to be a real letter. If you folks want to read about it, if you don't know about it, you can just put that in a search engine, Pike Mazzini letter, and it'll come up, the contents, the alleged contents. But there's something that goes beyond that. even though that was earlier, that was, I guess, in the late 19th century. But something was going on at the beginning of the 20th century, and I'm wondering why there were a number of literary personages that talked about a war late in the 20th century or early in the 21st century, and they all came down to kind of like the same participants. Now, what I mean is, well, we have Sir Halford Mackinder, who ran the idea of the Heartland and World Island, and we'll get to that in a second. And then you had a little-known figure by the name of Robert U. Benson that wrote Lord of the World in 1907. We'll get to that in a second, too. Now, we also have Cecil Rhodes and his Round Table, and the heir to that group, Lord Milner and his Kindergarten, and get the Fabian Socialists and all that, about which Quigley wrote. Now, all of them were in London, in and about London, at the turn of the century, early in the first decade of the 20th century. Orwell also must have known about this, because Mackinder kept on with his thesis into the 40s. And Orwell had to know about this, too, and there's a reason why I bring that in. So you have these characters, you have Mackinder, and you have Benson, and you have Rhodes, and the Round Table and all that, and Orwell, too. And Orwell, I do not consider malevolent whatsoever, and I don't either, I won't say any of them, but Mackinder, I think, just, well, how do they all know? We're going to read a little bit from their work, and they all kind of call it the same. Now, was it a coincidence? And it might have been, but, you know, this group of people in the same city at the same time, talking about what might be a third world war. And I just wonder why that is. Orwell, I think, capped it and gave us a last warning. Orwell, to me, and we go back and forth with Gordon Comstock about this, not that we disagree, but we find out more and more that in those last years of his life, he goes to Jura, a nasty damn place, to go write 1984. And you wonder why he went there if he was suffering from tuberculosis. Did he go there because he could write better in that solitude? Did he go there because perhaps somebody had designs or some people had designs on him after writing Animal Farm and knowing, maybe having some idea that he was off to write something else that was not going to be flattering of the way globalist plans foretold or blueprinted the idea of the world government and how it would treat its citizens? Or did he go up there, whatever, I mean, was he actually, in a way, starting a clock off ticking toward the end of his life, and he raced it to try to get 1984 done? And rumor has it that 1984 was originally titled 1948, but he wanted to make it more futuristic because people wouldn't buy that it was happening then, but of course it was. And so I think that quite clearly Orwell is a good guy who, after a stint probably with the BBC writing propaganda, that was the end of it. That was enough. But I think Orwell's probably three or four people throughout his lifetime, and who of us are not? But that for another time, because I gave that book, which I read excerpts of in the old days, Ian Slater's The Road to Airstrip 1. That's, I think, a great look into Orwell. So what I want to do is start off with a setup of this book, Lord of the World. And apparently it was a little bit too gloomy and perhaps too much on the money, because later on, Robert U. Benson would write Dawn of All. It's almost like kind of like a damage control thing. But a little bit about Benson. It says here, and this comes from CatholicAuthors.com, perhaps the clearest evidence of Benson's genius is to be found in the ease with which he crossed literary genres. Aside from his historical romances, he was equally at home with novels about a contemporary setting, such as The Necromancers, a cautionary tale about the dangers of spiritualism, or with futuristic fantasies, such as The Lord of the World. The latter novel is truly remarkable and deserves to stand beside Huxley's Brave New World and Orwell's 1984 as a classic of dystopian fiction. It's not fiction, folks. You know, it is. It's futuristic, let's call it that. There is no such thing as science fiction. In fact, though Huxley's and Orwell's modern masterpieces may merit equal praise as works of literature, they are clearly inferior as works of prophecy. The political dictatorships that gave Orwell's novel Nightmare an ominous potency have had their day. Well, boy, are they wrong there. All right, today his cautionary fable serves merely as a timely reminder of what has been and what may be again if the warnings of history are not heeded. Well, I mean, which is it, folks? I mean, this is kind of contradictory the way they write it. But again, we said that Orwell warned us, and here it says, if the warnings of history are not heeded. Well, that's exactly what's going on. So they gave themselves a little bit of an out. Benson's novel Nightmare, on the other hand, is coming true before our very eyes. The world depicted in Lord of the World is one where creeping secularism and godless humanism have triumphed over religion and traditional morality. It is a world where philosophical relativism has triumphed over objectivity. A world where, in the name of tolerance, religious doctrine is not tolerated. It is a world where euthanasia is practiced widely and religion hardly practiced at all. The lord of this nightmare world is a benign-looking politician intent on power in the name of peace, and intent on the destruction of religion in the name of truth. In such a world, only a small and shrinking church stands resolutely against the demonic lord of the world. Another take on this work comes from, it's www.ad2000.com.au, and it's entitled Robert U. Benson, Christianity and Modernism, by Sister Mary St. Rita. Yeah, right. Anyway, it gets down to this. While still at Cambridge Rectory, you wrote Lord of the World. This is Benson. A book which created a greater reaction than any of his other works. In this book, he portrays the Antichrist and gives an account of the effects which might reasonably be expected if modern thought was prolonged far enough. Once you accepted the Catholic faith, you also accepted the authority of the Church in its entirety and was most sensitive to anything which could hurt that Church which he loved with all his being. Thus, he was quick to perceive the trend toward modernism within the Church and the danger it posed to the whole supernatural fabric of religion. Pope Pius X signed Pascendi Gregis, probably the longest encyclical ever written, on September 8, 1907. You actually finished writing his book, Lord of the World, 2 months before that date, although it was not published until 1908. In view of the state of confusion in the Church today, it would be an enlightening study to read these publications and compare them. Julian Felsenberg, who in the world, Lord of the World represents Antichrist, is the quintessence of natural perfection, while Percy Franklin, who is a representative of Christianity, bears such a strong resemblance to Felsenberg that they could be taken quite easily for one another. You draws a remarkable true picture of the world today, both from a religious point of view and also with regard to the inventions of science. He graphically describes the problem of all the priests leaving the Church and saying, I can no longer believe. At one point, there is an interview between Father Percy Franklin and a priest who has come to tell him that he had lost his faith. It is hard to know where blame could be assigned, yet Percy's faith told him that there was blame due. The alliance of psychology and materialism did indeed seem, looked at from one angle, to account for everything. In ages of faith, In ages of faith, a very inadequate grasp religion would pass muster. I guess it meant grasp of religion would pass muster. In these searching days, it needed a robust supernatural perception to understand their practical inadequacy. In Hugh's book, and that was a quote from Percy, dialogue. In Hugh's book, Lord of the World, Protestantism no longer exists. That's breaking Earhart. It is a drawn battle between the forces of supernatural religion, personified by the Catholic Church, on the one hand, and the worship of man and nature on the other. And lastly, you, however, makes the issue quite plain. While Pope Pius X drew attention to the fact that the chief policy of the modernists is to create confusion so that, quote, there are Catholics and priests who, we would fain believe, abhor such enormities, yet act as if they fully approved of them. And it is the atmosphere of confusion within the Church which has enabled the modernists in our time to achieve their aim, the obliteration of the supernatural. And that's why I think it's interesting also that we have this acknowledgement by Ratzinger and the Vatican that aliens do exist. I guess you could call them extraterrestrials. And I also think that it's rich that he would do this at this time, because Ratzinger said some interesting things in the time he's been the Pope. And he's there for a reason to change a lot of things. He's been billed as a, what was it, a transition pope. I've never heard that used about any pope in my lifetime, which means it seems that he's not going to serve unto death. What is he making the way straight for? The last pope? I think so. But with this idea about ETs being real and benign and without original sin, I'm thinking that this is setting up and preparing people for something a few years off, maybe 10 years, I don't know, to accept something otherworldly as perhaps a false second coming of Christ, I don't know, or some kind of entity that people just like freak and say, whoa, you know, I mean, this has got to be the real deal. I think it's preparing people to accept something from above that is going to be ultimately a ruse. Now, I just want to get into a little section of this book, Lord of the World, and it depicts a scene supposedly around the turn of the century, around 2000. So we're looking at a book written in 1907 and taking a look at the way things might be in 2000, and just check this out. So here we have a conversation in the book between three individuals. I'm just going to just hit on a couple of things that, and the reason I'm doing this is this is how Benson showed the world as it would be in conflict, and those, empires that would exist at that time. This is where it's going to go back to Mackinder, too. Not that so much of Mackinder thought there would be another world war, although, admittedly, if he's talking about that the last empire, if there is to be one, the power that would be that empire would have to win the battle for World Island, which we'll talk about later. And to do that, you had to also hold the pivot point in that landmass from Lisbon to Vladivostok, which was called by Mackinder the Heartland. All right, but here we go to Lord of the World. And they're talking a little bit about history here, and Percy says, I forget what the old system was. And he's responded to with this comment. Why, it seems incredible, but the old system was that all paid alike. First came the Heirloom Act, and then the change by which inherited wealth paid three times the duty of earned wealth, leading up to the acceptance of Karl Marx's doctrines in 89, the year 89. But the former came in 77. And this refers back to with an abolition of inheritance, one of the 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto written by the bankers, not Karl Marx. The comment goes on, well, all these things kept England up to the level of the continent, meaning Europe. She had only been just in time to join in with the final scheme of Western free trade. Were we looking at the coming European Union at that time? That was the first effect, you remember, of the socialists' victory in Germany. And how do we keep out of the Eastern War, asked Percy anxiously. Oh, that's a long story, but in a word, America stopped us, so we lost India and Australia. I think that was the nearest to the downfall of the communists since 1925. But Braithwaite got out of it very cleverly by getting us the protectorate of South Africa once and for all. He was an old man then, too. Was he talking about Rhodes? Mr. Templeton stopped to cough again. Father Francis sighed and shifted in his chair. And America? Asked Percy. Ah, all that is very complicated, but she knew her strength and annexed Canada the same year. That was when we were at our weakest, meaning England. Percy stood up. Have you a comparative atlas, sir? He asked. The old man pointed to a shelf. There, he said. Percy looked at the sheets a minute or two in silence, spreading them on his knees. It's all much simpler, certainly, he murmured, glancing first at the old complicated coloring of the beginning of the 20th century and then at the three great washes of the 21st. What you're looking at is a color-coded map. So three great washes means you're going to get three empires coming here. And remember, he says the beginning of the 20th century and actually, you know, they were at that time, they were at the beginning of the 20th century. So even though he wrote it in a futuristic sense in the 20th century, actually it was the beginning of the 21st century when this stuff would start to emerge. as we're seeing right now. Percy moved his finger along Asia. The words Eastern Empire ran across the pale yellow, that's the coloring of that particular empire, from the Ural Mountains on the left to the Bering Straits on the right, curling round in giant letters through India, Australia, and New Zealand. He glanced at the red. It was considerably smaller, but still important enough considering that it covered not only Europe proper, but all Russia up to the Ural Mountains and Africa to the south. The blue-labeled American Republic swept over the whole of that continent and disappeared right round to the left of the Western Hemisphere in a shower of blue sparks on the White Sea. That blue sparks, I'm assuming, would mean islands off to the west, and that might even foretell the annexation of Hawaii. So that was the color-coded map where you have the Eastern Empire, Europe, and the American Republic. Starting to sound a little bit like Orwell. Later on it says, God knows, he said, if the Eastern Empire chooses to move, we can do nothing. I don't know why they have not moved. I suppose it is because of religious differences. Europe will not split? Asked the priest. No, no. We know our danger now, and America would certainly help us. But all the same, God help us, or you, I should rather say, if the Empire does move, she knows her strength at last. There was a silence for a moment or two. A faint vibration trembled through the deep-sunk room as some huge machine went past on the broad boulevard overhead. Prophecy, sir, said Percy suddenly. I mean about religion. Mr. Templeton inhaled another long breath from his instrument. Then again he took up his discourse. Briefly, he said, there are three forces, Catholicism, humanitarianism, and the Eastern religions. About the third I cannot prophesy, though I think the Sufis will be victorious. That's interesting. Would that be Islam? Anything may happen. Esotericism is making enormous strides, and that means pantheism, and the blending of the Chinese and Japanese dynasties throws out all our calculations. Now here we have the Eastern Empire being made of, obviously, a Sino-amalgam. But in Europe and America, there is no doubt that the struggle lies between the other two. We can neglect everything else. And I think, if you wish me to say what I think, that humanly speaking, Catholicism will decrease rapidly now. It is perfectly true that Protestantism is dead. Men do recognize at last that a supernatural religion involves an absolute authority, and that private judgment in matters of faith is nothing else than the beginning of disintegration. And it is also true that since the Catholic Church is the only institution that even claims supernatural authority with all its merciless logic, she has again the allegiance of practicality, all Christians who have any supernatural belief left. There are a few faddists left, especially in America and here, but they are negligible. That is all very well. But on the other hand, you must remember that humanitarianism, contrary to all persons' expectations, is becoming an actual religion itself, though anti-supernatural. It is pantheism. It is developing a ritual order under Freemasonry. Oh, no, not that. It has a creed, God is man, and the rest. Of course, we know that is Gnosticism. It is therefore a real food of a sort to offer to religious cravings. It idealizes and yet it makes no demand upon the spiritual faculties. Then they have the use of all the churches except ours and all the cathedrals, and they are beginning at last to encourage sentiment. Then they may display their symbols and we may not. I think that they will be established legally in another 10 years at the latest. So this somewhat comes up to what I think we're going to see, and that's a World War III blamed on religious differences, and that, I think, is inherent in what Benson is writing here and what you're listening to in the dialogue. And then lastly, it says, I think it's touch and go. The only remarkable thing is that here hardly anybody seems to realize it. It's too big for the imagination, I suppose. Those are key words. There is no doubt that the East has been preparing for a descent on Europe for these last 5 years. They have only been checked by America, and this is one last attempt to stop them. So there you have actually three power bases. Sometimes there is balance in odd numbers, and that would be a case for it. I also want to tell you that the language they alternately use with their own, and with the Catholics using Latin, the same alternative is Esperanto. This coming from back in 1908. All right, about Sir Halford Mackinder. I believe I read this in entirety, this article that appears in American Scholar in the winter edition, 1945-1946. Mackinder was to be 85 on February 15th, 1946. And it's called Mackinder's Heartland by Hans W. Weigert. And just to get the high spots here, this one paragraph about Mackinder was outstanding among modern geographers in showing history, geography set in motion, to be part of the life of the world organism and in basing a system of human geography on the thesis that the world has become a closed unit. To stress that this basis of Mackinder's approach to political geography at a time when global war and global geography are current coin sounds like carrying coals to Newcastle. Global concepts, however, are of recent date. It remains to be seen whether they will survive the war or whether competing and contrasting close space ideas such as geographic isolation or continentalism will not regain the ground they have lost since Pearl Harbor. Mackinder's contribution will be fully appreciated only if we realize now that the post-war temptation will be to build a politico-geographical world which would justify continental regionalism, especially in North America and the USSR. And I want to go back to something, because this is kind of interesting, and then we'll go ahead. But just about the ideas that were in the minds of a certain military powers around the end of World War One. Again, going back to his Heartland hypothesis, it said they were curiously attracted by the mystery and glamour woven around the Heartland and World Island, catchwords of what seemed to be a new geography. Their curiosity increased when they learned that Mackinder's warnings, addressed to the peacemakers assembled in Paris in 1919, had been duly noted and clearly understood by one of the enemy, General Karl Haushofer, who initiated the blueprints for a, quote, transcontinental bloc, unquote, reaching from the Rhine to the Yangtze. It was to be based upon collaboration between Germany and Japan with the USSR and China, and would result eventually by, quote, peaceful penetration, unquote, in German leadership among the great land powers. While the German general staff adopted Haushofer's teachings, Hitler discarded them when he committed the decisive blunder of World War II in ordering his generals to attack the Soviet Union. The mysteries of the Heartland and the effect which Mackinder's ideas had on the enemy were exciting enough to occupy the interest of his readers in 1942 and later, and to distract them from the broader aspects of his political world geography. However, it is these broader aspects which are the problems of a new generation of peacemakers. And I would contend that Hitler's blunder to attack the Soviet Union was basically, he got the orders that Germany was going to start to throw the war. Because Hitler to me was handled, I don't think there's any two ways about it, just like Churchill and Roosevelt. And one of the ways that you can, you know, in Europe at least, dash your army is to go ahead and try to invade Russia. That's what dashed Napoleon and the army of France, the Grand Army of France, on the rocks. Not a good idea. It happened in World War One, and it happened in World War Two. So I don't think it's a blunder. Hitler was told, that's it. You're going down for the count on this one. Your work is done, and you're about to throw the war. All right, now on to Mackinder's Heartland. Mackinder's consciousness of the passing of the Victorian Sea Power Age made him see Europe and its political geography as subordinate to Asia. It is in Asia that land power and land-based air power have had their greatest opportunities to challenge established power positions in the world at large. The mobility of land power, in parentheses, not land power as such, in the parentheses, in competition with the mobility of sea power, evolved as a decisive geopolitical feature of the 20th century. By evaluating the competition and possible clash between sea and land power, Mackinder discovered the pivot region of the world's politics, the heartland of Eurasia, and he did not hesitate to project the effects which an increasing mobility of military and economic power in this area is bound to have on the rest of the world. In 1904, he saw that the century will not be old before Asia is covered with railways. The spaces within the Russian Empire and Mongolia are so vast, and their potentialities in population, wheat, cotton, fuel, and metals so incalculably great, that it is inevitable that a vast economic world, more or less apart, will there develop inaccessible to ocean commerce. That's a quote from Mackinder. Going on to the narrative, this political area Mackinder projected as an organic unit within the world unit, inaccessible to ships but covered with a network of railways, the continental basins of Eurasia are seen as the homeland of the new Russia, which is successor to the Mongol Empire. From its central position, Russia can exert pressure on Finland, Scandinavia, Poland, Turkey, Persia, now Iran, and India. The centrifugal power which drove the horse-riding nomads of the steppes westward and southward against the settled peoples of Europe is still a living force in the Russian heartland. If ever it succeeded in expanding over the marginal lands of Eurasia, if ever it were able to use its continental resources for fleet building, then Mackinder felt, and this is a quote, the empire of the world would be in sight, unquote. And to leave no doubt about the direction of his fears 40 years ago, he added, this would happen if Germany would ally herself with Russia. When Mackinder re-examined his original thesis at the close of the First World War, he found that his thesis of 1984 still sufficed. Hence his warning, who rules Eastern Europe commands the heartland. Who rules the heartland commands the world island. Who rules the world island commands the world. It became much too smooth a slogan when it was dusted off in our day. Most of those who used it persistently were fascinated more by the general appeal of the slogan than by its geographic realities. But remember, too, and I'll say something about it later on, that Brzezinski used that dictum in his book, The Grand Chessboard, which is, you would say an extrapolation or a treatment, which he does credit Mackinder for originating. Going on to Weigert's article, the heartland of Europe and Asia had essentially the same frontiers in 1918 as Mackinder's pivot area of 1904. It comprised the vast expanse of the continental inland basins of Arctic and continental drainage, which measure nearly half of Asia and a quarter of Europe, and which are inaccessible from the ocean. As a strategical concept, the heartland includes all regions which can be denied sea power. Railways growing and expanding inward have changed its face continuously since 1904 and have tested Mackinder's thesis. The airplane has since appeared in skies over the heartland as a new instrument of geographical surgery, and Mackinder greets it as an ally to land power in the heartland. The First World War, Mackinder sees as the climax in the eternal conflict between continental land power and marginal power backed and fed by sea power. His quote, we have been fighting lately in the close of the war, a straight duel between land power and sea power. We have conquered, but had Germany conquered, she would have established her sea power on a wider basis than any in history, and in fact on the wildest possible base. End of quote. The third and final test of the Heartland formula was undertaken by Mackinder in the article The Round World and the Winning of the Peace, which he wrote in 1943 for Foreign Affairs. And you can find that because I read from that also. I can't find it now, but I did read that article, and you can't find it. You go to a library and go back, and perhaps in the microfilm or whatever, 1943, Foreign Affairs, The Round World, and the Winning of the Peace. To Mackinder, the test was positive. He found his concept more valid and useful today than it was either 20 or 40 years ago. Yet while the original concept of the heartland remained basically intact, its frontiers were significantly revised. The revisions were required in order to accommodate certain major changes in the political geography of the world since 1904 and 1918. The territory of the USSR remains equivalent to the heartland, but there is one rather important exception. A vast area within the Soviet Union, which begins east of the Yenisei River and whose central feature is the Lena River, is now split from the original heartland. Lena Land, Russia, has an area of 3.75 million square miles, but a population of only some 6 million. In contrast to Heartland Russia, which covers 4.25 million square miles and has a rapidly growing population, now numbering 170 million. Heartland Russia, backed by the natural reserves of Lena Land, looms with greater power than the Heartland Mackinder envisaged in decades past. What earlier had seemed to be mere speculation had now grown into reality, and Mackinder could state as a fact that, quote, except in a very few commodities, the country is capable of producing everything which it requires, end of quote. But he continues. Again, he views the open western frontier of the heartland. His conclusion that, quote, if the Soviet Union emerges from the war as conqueror of Germany, she must rank as the greatest land power on the globe, unquote, is slightly less emphatic than his vision of the approaching empire of the world in 1904. Otherwise, the Britisher's view of the geopolitical relationship of Russia and Germany had remained unchanged. And finally, Mackinder's citadel of land power still stands, and mightier than ever. and it is not merely the heartland quality of its landmass that accounts for its leading role in today's world theater. Equally important are the wealth of its resources and the human intangibles which make a nation great. In the political and economic geography of a shrinking world, location is not a static element. Its value changes constantly. The United States and the Soviet Union are about to revise their politico-geographical contacts. The northward course of both nations accounts for some of the major changes. Equally, the relationship of China and the USSR is expected to change radically. The long inland frontier between these two nations will grow in significance in the next few decades, and stimulating or contagious ideas will not be halted by ancient walls. Such contacts will affect the rest of the world and particularly the role of the heartland. Finally, there is the human factor, the differences in vitality among the great nations, which are paramount among the factors that will change the relations of the heartland to the rest of the world. The balance of manpower is shifting. At present, the shift favors the vigorously growing nations within the USSR and will continue to do so for decades to come. It is emphasized by the fact stressed by Ellsworth Huntington that biological inheritance has produced qualities in the heartland people which compensate for its climatic handicaps. This trend but underlines the significance of Mackinder's heartland vision. Yet a future cycle in the evolution of the world's population that is growing much too rapidly, growing in spite of the appalling blood sacrifices of the war, will make the demographic problems of new powers of China and India a world problem. Moreover, it will affect deeply the power position of the heartland people and of Western nations. I am afraid that Mackinder's new balance of power doctrine, a world divided into two equal, therefore free, hemispheres of 1 billion human beings each, is a structure built upon shifting sand. And I would only interject that I think what we see is still a threesome here. I still think you're looking at Russia, Slavs, Slavs, not Slavs, and also Asians. Here it was talked about an amalgamation of China and Japan. The Koreans were not mentioned, of course. So I think you're still talking a threesome. You still have something going on here. Although Mackinder would say that it isn't about the Western Hemisphere any longer, but there's still a player, as I think you also saw in Benson's book, The Lord of the World. So I still think there's a triad going on here, not necessarily just two major powers. All right, going on with Weigert's article, the weakness of Mackinder's doctrine does not lie in its emphasis on the citadel of land power as pivotal in world affairs. It lies rather in the attempt to construct a balance of power formula which can be applied permanently to the relationship of the heartland and the rest of the world. Since Mackinder first started out to demonstrate how geographical sense is essential in acquiring a valid new worldview, new pivot areas have evolved and still others will emerge. The growth of American power particularly has prompted Mackinder to revise his formula. Other areas and their peoples will come of age, and new lines of communications will transform international relations. No balance of power thesis can solve permanently the geopolitical problems of tomorrow. That is the vital lesson which Mackinder himself taught us. The world's nations have realized that they henceforth must live, quote, in a closed system in which they can do nothing of which the repercussion does not come back upon them from the very antipodes. Well, here again, you still have a situation of trying to effect some kind of balance of power. But in looking at Orwell, here he has a notion of three major powers, Asia, East Asia, and Oceania. And I'm not saying he obviously birthed that. He may very well have taken it off Mackinder. And so that's okay. But the thing is, if he did do that, he saw validity in it. And I don't know that in Slater's, I wouldn't call it a biography, I guess in a way it is, of Orwell, that Mackinder was a factor in there. I'll have to ask Gordon Comstock, because I've since given him the book to read. I don't know that I saw that in there. But still, you have this sense of it all taking place, this vying for a last empire. And how do you do that without war? I mean, economically, you can't do it, because obviously that's all rigged by the bankers anyway. What China's doing could not happen unless it was obviously fostered and supported by the world bankers. So we're still looking at something which I think does more than intimate a third world war, and it will take place on that landmass. And my contention is the reason why the U.S. military is over there is to partake in this, shall we say, shot at running the table. So here we are over in, it's not about the oil, it's not about terrorism. I think it's about making a play to own World Island. And clearly what Mackinder was saying is, I mean, it's not going to be about sea power. You're not going to go out and duke it out on the oceans, although the ocean's going to be key, obviously, to the United States, which now wants, you know, once again will bring war somewhere else. And it may not be that easy to sustain and supply boots on the ground in a large conflagration in Eurasia. But still, here they have Iraq and Afghanistan, and in the middle is Iran. If they could take Iran, that would give them basically three big dominoes who has coast on, I guess, what's the Gulf of Oman, and gives them access to the Indian Ocean and access, obviously, to going either to the Pacific or the Atlantic. And yet, how much would it take to transport material and personnel from the Mediterranean through, I guess that would be Jordan, perhaps, and Syria? I mean, we have troops in Kazakhstan, we have troops in Ukraine, and I just see this as the beginning of trying to get a toehold in what's going to be the biggest game of risk this globe has ever seen. And that's why I say that, you know, how do these folks know, or how do they get supposedly the bones to think about a third world war or a war between three superpowers? And, of course, Brzezinski and the Grand Chessboard stated at least twice that it would be unwise for the United States to get into it with Iran, basically, because it would create from that friction an axis of China, Russia, and Iran. Really three kind of distinctly separate peoples, if you will. But the old deal of the enemy of your enemy is your friend, would they unite necessarily in vanquishing the unwanted guest on that chessboard, which would be the United States? And, of course, no one's talking anything about India. And just like it said in that piece by Weigert, you know, there's going to be a situation created where India and China will be heard from. So that's it. I mean, I didn't want to be pedantic about this, but I do believe that the reason why we're seeing what we've been seeing is not because of the Caspian pipeline. Whatever happened to that anyway? You know, how's that working for us as far as getting us more oil? And I don't believe it was about terrorism. I mean, I think one of the stupidest non sequiturs I've ever heard, an oxymoron, if you will, is that we're free here because we're fighting over there. It makes no sense. If you had a situation that took place, obviously, in the United States, and it was about immigration, and it was about bad guys being inside here, here's where you got to deal with the problem. You don't go somewhere else, because if you don't let them in, technically, they can't hurt you. But no, we have to go someplace else and find them in their backyard, where the never-ending supply of, obviously, now a generation of nihilistic fighters, who are very dangerous because they really don't care to live. And that makes for a very, I think, dangerous fighting force. And they can be fed by both China and Russia. They can be proxied by both of those countries. And I think that's what's happening. And you're going to get punched out. And finally, you're going to fall to your knees. And that's what's going to happen to us over there while nobody's home here. All right, so that's it with as far as this whole thing about three powers in the future, as foreseen by a number of people, and I would say of literary note. If you are interested, you can go on online and find Benson's two books, Lord of the World and Dawn of All, which is kind of like, you know, like I told you, he hit the vein too much with Lord of the World, so he kind of like made this really nice, you know, everything's okay book, Dawn of All. I have the two PDFs. If you're interested, I will email them to you. Of course, it'll be as an attachment. If you want to go look for it yourself, you're very free to do so. I think at least Lord of the World bears some reading. It's got some very interesting items in there. Was Benson prescient, or did he have insight to what was going on, as obviously things were happening in the city of London, which, again, is a major power base, the one of two in this world. That's the end of Part A, if you will, of These Days, Volume 1. What's going to happen is we're going to go to volume part B, which is something I just recorded back in the mid-March. Some things that were happening at the time, I was not necessarily a really great mood, but that will be part B, and we'll keep this going, I guess, as a form of the old garage sales and such that we had. Okay, now on to part B.